Never know.
All right, so this is the public history 486, I believe it is. Interview with Mr. Jerry Poling, author of A Summer Up North, Henry Aaron, and The Legend of Eau Claire Baseball. First, Jerry, let's thank you for coming by and helping us out with this.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it.
I just wanted to talk about baseball, and especially a subject that I know. So,
well, we're going to start off, you know, with the book. Obviously, a really fantastic undertaking. What was really the inspiration behind writing A Summer Up North?
I would say two things. One was the statue celebration in 1994, and I was involved in that and had a role in kind of helping get that committee started that started the statue. I was one of the people that helped form the committee and was involved in the development of the statue and raising the money for it and all that. So when we did get that put together and put the statue up, and then I was there that day, and because I was involved in the committee pretty much from the start, I got to be one of the people who follow Hank Aaron around that day. So when I saw kind of that from the inner workings and the enthusiasm people had for honoring Hank Aaron, and then just that day itself and all of the people that showed up and just all the celebratory atmosphere that was involved in it, and just people celebrating not only Hank Aaron but the way baseball used to be in Eau Claire in the 50s when they had minor league teams here. I mean, that just sort of resonated with me, and I thought, wow, this was a bigger deal maybe than I even realized. I knew all these really good players had played in Eau Claire, you know, Aaron and Torrey and Euchre and all that, and I'd read about it and all that, but for some reason that day it just sort of hit me. It's like, wow, people must have really appreciated the baseball back then and what it meant to the city and having these minor league players come up and then go on to be professionals. And so that was one thing that sort of struck me. I thought, you know, this was so important. It seems to me like there's a way to chronicle, you know, what Eau Claire's baseball history was all about. Because nobody had ever done that I was aware of. I mean, there have been a lot of stories out there, you know, a lot of articles written, and the Leader-Telegram had written several pretty lengthy articles about the history of baseball in Eau Claire over the years. So I knew there's a lot of information out there, but, you know, I think one role of a book is to pull information together that's out there and put it somewhere where it's all in one spot. And you don't have to go to the public library and the Leader-Telegram archives and go do interviews with people. You can hopefully find a credible source where it's all put together, so a chronicle. So I thought that was important to chronicle that. So the other thing I think that struck me was I'd heard a lot of stories about Hank Aaron and what his season was like in Eau Claire. And there were a lot of different types of stories, and I never quite knew which ones were correct. I'd heard half a dozen stories of places he'd lived, and I thought, he couldn't have lived at like five places in 3 months. There's no way. And so I'd hear things like that. I'd hear things like, oh, he really was treated poorly when he was in Eau Claire. And I thought, well, was he really? I'd never heard him say that. You know, and I thought, I'm just kind of interested to really find out put down in a book what really, as best I could find out, what really I think happened that summer in terms of how the people treated him, what he thought of Eau Claire, and get sort of a definitive account. So those are probably the two big things. You know, sort of celebrating Eau Claire's baseball history, putting in all that history, at least, not all of it, but, as it relates to Hank Aaron and sort of the bigger things that happened, and then try to chronicle Aaron's summer as best I could. So those were probably the two big driving factors behind wanting to write it.
Now, going off of the whole idea behind the history of baseball in Eau Claire, in your research, did you find that maybe the history of the baseball in Eau Claire mirrored a lot of other, not so, well, I guess this would be considered a small town by most standards, but the evolution of baseball in Eau Claire, do you find that maybe was kind of on the same lines throughout the entire country, or was that something that was uniquely Wisconsin?
I think it seemed to me like it was pretty close to, you know, I didn't do, you know, I read enough about what was going on in baseball around the country, but it seemed fairly close. You know, if you look at baseball in the United States when it gets started in the, you know, like 40s, 30s, 40s, I guess, when it really started. So, and then you've got baseball, and, you know, and there were no people in Eau Claire, not even Indians in Eau Claire in 1850. You know, there might have been a few, well, 1840s, I think there were a few, lumber, I mean, like fur track traders and drivers.
Right.
I mean, so, I mean, there couldn't have been baseball here that early. But by 1865, after the Civil War, 1867, I think, was the first game that was played here. So, you know, roughly within 10 years of there being a settlement here and there being a city here, we got baseball here. So I think, yeah, I mean, it was starting to take off across the country, and as population moved west, you could see baseball sort of populating these smaller towns as it moved west. So I think, yeah, just about as early as you really could hopefully have a baseball team here, you had one. And it was, you know, it was becoming the national pastime really already in some ways. You know, there were other big sports at the time. I think boxing was big. There was horse racing was big. You know, but baseball was sort of taking over as one of those sports that people seemed to get into pretty quickly. So looking that far back, you could say, yes, it sort of was mirroring, you know, where baseball was showing up in the country that early. And by the 1880s, you had some professional players in Eau Claire. I mean, these were probably semi-pro teams, but they were paying guys to come in and play for these teams in Eau Claire. You know, in the old driving park, was just down in this neighborhood way over there. So, I mean, there was already some professional baseball here in the 1880s. Then you look at the early 1900s, and you've sort of got town teams to some degree, but again, there's some sort of professionalism involved in it. You know, Burley Grimes playing here in 1912, and then going on to play in the majors. And again, this was a place he came to play because I think he saw it as a developmental step for him to get out of Clear Lake and get to a bigger town. So it wasn't a minor league team yet, but it was sort of looked at as a stepping stone. There were a bunch of guys who played in the Eau Claire prior to us having a minor league team here who made it to the majors, quite a few of them actually. Some of them maybe only playing a few games here and there in the majors, but there were a lot of guys who went on. Mirroring the U.S. development of baseball, I think that was pretty accurate. So then, what was it, 1933, then we get the first minor league team here. So I don't know, you know, how to place that in relation to other minor league teams in the United States, if the minor league farm teams are developing that heavily around the U.S., but I think that's pretty much in line with other things going on in the U.S. in terms of minor league baseball spreading to small towns. It was probably, again, more prevalent in the South and the East before it hit here, but I think that's fairly early. In 1933, you've got a minor league team here already, a professional minor league team affiliated with major league teams. Of course, then you see, you know, I mean, in terms of what's happening in the U.S., you don't see any black players here until 1950, which is, you know, three years after Jackie Robinson breaks the color barrier. So that, again, is sort of mirroring what's happening in the U.S., which is kind of cool in a way. I mean, and that's, you look at some major league teams, what was it, one of the last major league teams didn't have a black player until the late 50s, I believe. So, I mean, we had black players here before some major league teams, I believe, even had them. In a sense, we're mirroring, again, what's going on in the United States. During World War II, I think there were a couple of years there where there weren't teams in Eau Claire. I'm trying to remember exactly what happened there. Because I didn't do a lot of research in the 40s, but I think there were a couple seasons where there weren't teams because of World War II. So, I mean, that kind of reflects what was going on in the U.S. I think just in general, I would think that, yeah, that's what kind of struck me, is that what happened in the U.S. was happening in a microcosmic way in Eau Claire in baseball. Seeing these, you know, good young players come through here hitting the major leagues, people in Eau Claire being excited about Major League Baseball, and then having the minor league team here to sort of fuel that enthusiasm about Major League Baseball. They would have, you know, not only the young minor league players here, but you'd sometimes would get major league. The Milwaukee Braves would send scouts here, of course, so there was a sense that there were major league people in town from time to time. And they would have these promotional dinners where the Braves would send maybe, you know, like 1962, Joe Torre and Hank Aaron came back for, kind of promote the Milwaukee Braves in Wisconsin. And there were other times when other well-known Milwaukee Braves would come here and speak or do something like that. So there was that connection to the major league game here that was pretty exciting, I think, for local people. I would say, right, in terms, I mean, there's probably other ways you could connect it, but I think at least from a purely baseball standpoint, yeah, I think it reflected what's going on nationally. You're seeing a lot of the developmental talent, and then just, and the Northern League, too. It wasn't just Eau Claire, but all of the good players who were coming through the Northern League that were going on to the majors, and people here could see those players. So you saw all these good players, and you saw the talent that were coming out of the small towns, and you'd see players come through Eau Claire, and you had a chance to really get a sense for what was happening in baseball around the U.S. by seeing, I mean, there's guys from Harvard and all these major colleges, and coming to Eau Claire to play baseball. I mean, Princeton, whatever. I mean, some of these great schools. And it's kind of like Eau Claire now with the Express. Well, these guys now had signed pro contracts, and they're, you know, and they're coming here with a reputation already that they're going to be, you know, they were maybe, I don't know if they had draft picks back then, but they were highly sought after college players who had signed contracts and were expected to be good young players. So, I don't know if that totally answers your question. Or...
Well, yeah, follows kind of along the lines of the history there. But going off of Hank Aaron and breaking the color barrier and whatnot, the media, I'm guessing, probably had a huge role in covering, like, Jack Robinson's breaking of the color barrier and just the advancement of baseball, and you yourself are a baseball media man. How would you say that the media coverage of baseball has changed? A couple of topics that are being covered in our class are focused specifically on the media aspect and how that has maybe shaped the history of baseball or shaped the social views in baseball.
Yeah.
How would you say that the media coverage of baseball has changed over time?
From what period to what period would you referring to? Like from the pre-Jackie Robinson days till now?
We'll say from the Jackie Robinson era to the way things have followed up.
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, just from a pure standpoint of how they refer to blacks in the media, I mean, it's changed drastically, of course. I mean, you went from a time when the media didn't cover the Negro Leagues. I mean, mainstream media didn't cover the Negro Leagues at all. I mean, they weren't covering who won the Negro League World Series in the 1940s. I mean, nobody cared in mainstream newspapers. I don't know about, like, the Chicago papers, if they carried any Negro League news or not. Probably not much. They might have. I suspect there were more black papers that carried and covered that. So, I mean, mainstream media didn't even cover the blacks at all. And then finally, when Robinson broke in, and in the early years of Aaron playing in Eau Claire, I mean, there were mostly references to them being black players. There were a couple points in my book. I think it was the first. Was it the first year? I remember one of the first black players who came to Eau Claire. You know, they were announced in the paper and had a picture of them as the first black players coming to Eau Claire. So I mean, it was a, you know, sort of this sideshow almost. I mean, you wouldn't have that today. So I mean, they were treated as sort of in a much different way than they are now, with much less respect. But again, that sort of mirrors what was happening in the United States at the time, mm-hmm. too. I mean, Jackie Robinson, of course, was treated much differently than the average player when he broke in. I mean, it was pretty much a circus surrounding him in his first season or two in the major leagues. So you sort of expect the same thing to happen in Eau Claire, and it did. I mean, initially, there was a lot of, there's just a lot of concern, I think, as to whether black players would fit in here and how they'd be treated. And the black players themselves, you know, are a little concerned because they don't know if they're coming to a totally white city and what's it going to be like. As far as mainstream media goes and just covering, yeah, I mean, Aaron, well, I was looking back at my book today, and when he was named Rookie of the Year, he was announced as, you know, the third player of his race to win Rookie of the Year in the Northern League. You know, and he says now when he looks back at that, it kind of makes him mad that was the issue. It wasn't the fact that he had played so well, and Hank Aaron himself had been Rookie of the Year. It's that Hank Aaron, a black person, was Rookie of the Year, and that was sort of news yet back then. Which now it just seems weird to think about it, but there was still that mindset that blacks were different, and that somehow we're showing that blacks maybe are good at baseball, and we didn't know that before. And now you're sort of, so I think to the media, they had to almost point it out. And I don't know, I suppose that was just the mindset. But again, the story that said that was an Associated Press story. It wasn't a local story. It was a story that came through the Associated Press. So you've got the mainstream news gathering organization in the United States. UPI was pretty big at the time, too. But AP is actually using, you know, making a reference to his color in announcing that.
Do you still think that happens today? Like, when I think about that, I think about football. They'll say the first NFL black coach to win a Super Bowl, or the first black quarterback to win a Super Bowl. Like, those milestones are still, feel like, being covered.
Yeah, you're probably right. To some degree, I kind of forgot about that, but you're right. I think it is brought up.
Tomlin, I remember when Mike Tomlin. Yeah. No, yeah. Tomlin. Was it Tony Dungy that won
first?
Yeah,
first Tomlin. Super Bowl, I think.
Right. Yeah.
And then Mike Tomley, there's a huge issue with that about the hiring process that happened.
Yeah.
in the mid-2000s.
Right. Yeah, it still does happen, right, when those big things go on. Yeah, of course, I mean, Aaron was the perfect example. He broke Ruth's record. That was the issue. And so, yeah. I think it was more routinely done back then. Now you hear it just, I hear it less and less now because, well, there's fewer and fewer times that it happens where there's a milestone of a black breakthrough in some area.
Do you think the mindset is a lot different when it happened in the 50s? Yeah. Do you think it was more of they couldn't see that happening? You know, not just a black player breaking the color barrier, but also being successful.
Yeah.
Like winning, Jackie Robinson winning the Rookie of the Year.
Yeah, yeah. I think now it's more of just to me it's more of a footnote. I mean, sometimes it becomes a big deal, like when Tiger Woods won the Masters.
Yeah.
And Fuzzy Zeller, the golfer, made some offhanded joke. He was a jokester anyway, he's always making jokes. But he made a couple of jokes about Tiger Woods, and it became a big racial controversy because of what he said. And Tiger took offense to it. So I think it's more of a footnote unless somebody does it in a stupid way.
Right.
But back then, I would think it was more routine. It happened. I think it was pretty common to hear that. And I think people actually found it interesting. Now I don't know that people find it so interesting. It's just more, well, or such a big deal. I think it's still maybe interesting because sometimes it strikes you as like, oh my gosh, I mean, a black coach has never won the Super Bowl or whatever it might be. So I think it's kind of interesting. But back then, I think it was still more of a social issue where you... And because there had been so little interaction between blacks and whites in some areas, there was still sort of that just wonderment out there as to how they compare it as a race to the whites. And I think people still saw it as two separate types of people almost, which just seems stupid. But, I mean, I think hopefully everybody just thinks this, we're all just people.
Right.
And it doesn't really make a whole lot of difference what color your skin is.
Right.
You know?
Do you think that the media helped speed integration along? Do you think it hurt the process, or was it maybe sort of just a completely outside factor that really didn't matter at all?
I'm in the media, so I tend to think that most of the things the media do are, well, I'm not quite in the media as much as I used to be, but I mean, I used to work at the paper.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think, you know, most of what the media does is generally good because it gets issues out there and gets people talking about it. So, if they're doing things in a bad way, it certainly can hurt. But I think for the most part, when things like that become in the public eye and are being discussed by the public and they make headlines, I think things get resolved faster and issues become, you know, resolved quicker in society that way when the media does its job properly. You know, there's going to be media that don't do it right, but... is such a great place to exchange ideas and opinions that I think the media helps a lot. I mean, otherwise you just look at how things are today compared to even, you know, how slowly news moved back in the early part of the 20th century and now how it's moving now. Things just aren't hidden as much and they just get resolved faster. I think from that respect. Just that, you know, that kind of brings up the one part in the book when the first player who was going, the first black who was going to come to Eau Claire was Billy Bruton. And there was this controversy in the letters to the editor in the Eau Claire paper. And a bunch of people, I think there was, that was the...
I think it was a Toastmasters.
Toastmasters had passed some sort of resolution, right, to say, we don't think black players should come here because it's not a good place for them. Well, then all these letters to the editor start showing up. You know, people saying, well, that's ridiculous, you know. This is America, they can come here if they want, that type of thing. You know, most of the letters were very positive, of saying, well, that's, you know, we support black players here. And I think that was a huge factor in the fact that Billy Bruton did come here. I think he was going to come anyway, I don't think they could stop it. But I think it was a huge factor in how he was treated. I mean, all these people publicly said, what's wrong with him coming here? And when he came here, he was treated very well. I mean, he stayed at the house of a white coach and teacher, you know, and from what I understand, people really liked him here, and he liked the people that were here. You know, so if the media hadn't done, Media Avenue hadn't been there, the place for people to vent their opinions on this, and if the Toastmasters, you know, had maybe, that story had never gotten in the paper, and then the people hadn't responded to it, I mean, who would have known what the public mindset was? But I think everybody in the community at that point sort of had a feel for, you know, what was... at least both sides of the issue. There were some people opposed, but a lot of people were for it. So, so I think, you know, the media does an amazing, is an amazing, I'm trying to think of the right word, but resource for society to help resolve its issues in a, you know, a non-violent way.
You might be a little bit biased for this question, but do you think that the baseball media is a lot more important to the sport itself than perhaps like the football writers are to the NFL or other hockey writers? I think there are hockey writers. hockey writers to the NHL. Do you think that the relationship between baseball and media is a lot closer, or do you think that they're all kind of about the same?
Well, you know, if you'd asked me that 30 years ago, I probably would have said baseball probably is, but you know, football's changed so much now. I think there's just as much closeness with football writers and the sports they cover as there is baseball. I mean, baseball's got that incredible history of writers covering it to death for 100 years. You know, I mean, it's and you know they, I mean, they've always been there. They would ride on the trains with the teams. I mean that was a plum job as a sports writer back in, you know, throughout the 1900s, was if you could be a major league, cover a major league team. I mean, even when I was a sports writer in the 80s, that was still considered a plum job. I mean, to cover a major league team and go on the road with them and cover them every day. I never quite saw it as something I would want to do. To have to cover a baseball game, you know, 162 baseball games a year. It's like, oh my gosh, how do you come up with a lead 162 times? So, I mean, that... Yeah, I mean that the baseball's always been close. I mean the history's there and the people cover it because they know people know the history and you know. But football's become almost as popular, if not more popular, than baseball now. So I think you know the coverage of football. I read stuff from the Milwaukee Journal from their writers. I mean they've got you know every game they've got like six people at a game or six or seven people. You know baseball. I don't know if they have that many at baseball, primarily because there aren't as many games, but. I mean, 16 games versus 162, you know, each Packer game is a big deal, so they send a lot more people. But I think it's covered just as intently now. You know, hockey, basketball, I'm not sure. I think football is the one that stands out to me where there's probably just as much closeness. But that being said, you look at baseball, and it's like if football is equal to baseball, that's really saying something, because baseball has always held this sort of mystique in American sports society. And for football to get to that level is really saying something. Because, I mean, it is super popular, but baseball, I don't know which one's more popular. I mean, it's all up to public opinion. But yeah, I think baseball media is still right up there. I mean, it covers, I mean, you can't, nothing happens in baseball without anybody knowing it. I mean, it's still is covered extremely well. Does that answer your question, you think?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Kind of going back a little bit of ways to earlier in the interview, you mentioned that you were getting a lot of stories about Hank Aaron's time up here and about the history of baseball and whatnot when you were writing your book. Were there any stories that you decided not to put in the book, or was it just sort of more take any stories you can get, make sure they're facts, and then put them in?
Yeah. I don't remember any right offhand. I mean, I didn't put anything in if I couldn't. Corroborate it somehow and make sure that it was accurate or cross-check it with somebody else. You know, I don't remember any specifically, that I didn't put in. Because most of them, I think there were a couple times when people told me things and I found out they weren't quite true. Not that they were trying to lead me down the wrong path, but their memory maybe wasn't quite accurate. So, and I would either know that when they were telling me, they would say something, you know, like, oh, I knew this guy when he played that year, and I would just know it was wrong. Because I knew some of the facts, but I can't remember any specific stories or like controversial things that I left out. I think most of what I really wanted, I was able to get. I mean, there are things that I found out later on that I wish I would have, little bits and pieces of things that I wish I would have known. People that I'd met after the book came out, it's like, oh my gosh, I should have talked to you. I didn't know you knew that much or whatever. Things that popped up and. You know, that I ran into it. Partly it was because the book was out there, and then people I'd start talking to people about it, and they would start telling me stories. Like, oh, that would have been a good story.
Such as?
Well, the one that stands out to me was, and it wasn't a big thing at all, but I don't know if I even would have included it, but I mentioned that, I think it was in the prologue, that the two women who were living in Eau Claire in the 1950s were the Dear Abby and Ann Landers. Mm-hmm. They weren't called that then. They were just housewives in Eau Claire. But they went on to become the two famous columnists. And I'd called Ann Landers. I thought, well, she had to have gone to a baseball game. I mean, she is a real vivacious young woman and everything. And I thought she must have been going watching. I thought this would be cool to parallel two of the most famous people in America were living in Eau Claire in 1952. I thought, they had to be in the ballpark at some point together. I thought, this had to be. And that was the social place everybody went to the baseball games. I thought, okay. So I called her office, talked to her secretary, told her what I was doing. I wanted to interview her, and she wasn't giving any interviews, whatever, so that's fine. So can you just ask her if you ever went to any baseball games in Eau Claire in 1952? And she tells the secretary, no. So I think, okay, well, that's a good idea, but it didn't work out. I thought, that's kind of weird. Seems like she probably would have gone to a game. So after the book comes out, I run into this guy, I think his name now, Art Roach. He actually was on our committee, our baseball history committee. And he used to work up at the park. And he's one of the guys I wish I would have known because he used to hang out there. He worked at the concession stand. And he, you know, was just around the park a lot, knew all the key people. And so we were talking about that one day. And somehow he brought up Ann Landers and her sister. He says, oh, yeah, every night they would come into the game. he said they would. I would sit on the third base side, and they would always come in, like, second inning, third inning, he said, you know, and they would always wear these summer dresses. He says, you know, they would, you know, showing as much skin as they could back in those days. He says, they were a couple of good-looking young women. He said, really nice-looking. He said, they would always come in. They sat on the third base side. They'd come in on the first base side, and they would make sure after the crowd was all seated to come in just a little bit late. And you'd be looking really good, and then they would parade in front of everybody and then go take their seat. So it was like the same every night. I thought, oh, well, that makes me mad that she didn't tell me she used to go to games, unless she had forgotten for some reason, but that doesn't seem likely.
Right.
So I thought, well, that would have been a neat thing to parallel, you know, and show that. It didn't have anything to do with Aaron himself, but still just some things like that, you know,
show how important baseball was in Eau Claire to everybody that lived here.
Yeah, right. It would have been a fun story. And there might have been a few other little things, but I don't recall anything big offhand other than that. I mean, there were some other players on that team I wish I could have found. Like Julius Bowers, the other black player. I could never find him and talk to him. I don't know if he was alive yet at that point or not. It was funny because just recently I talked to his son. His son was trying to find out some information about his dad's minor league days, and he had contacted somebody in Eau Claire, and then they told him to call me, and I talked to him, and he didn't know a lot about his dad's career, but was just trying to find out more, so I just gave him some information. But there are a few other little things that have popped up over the years. If I would have talked to every player on that team if I could have found them. But, you know, at some point you got to move on. You keep trying to find names or looking to people's past and trying to think up where they might have ended up and try and locate them. And I did find some that way, just kind of digging around, trying to get lucky and find somebody, but I wish, you know, you wish you could find more, because you always feel as a writer that the more information you've got, you're better off, because it just, you have more stories, more information to cross-check with, more people to talk to. And so, but I did feel like overall that I talked to as many people as I think I needed or more to make a good story. I didn't feel like I was short at any point in certain areas, but still, that, you know, that researcher in you always wants to have a little bit more information. You always think there's got to be more out there. So,
Kind of going off script here, because I mean the book did come out before the Express came to Eau Claire.
Yeah.
Do you think that when with the Express arriving in Eau Claire, what year was that? 2009.
I'm thinking, was it five? Was it?
Was it that long? Oh wow. I feel old.
Wait, no. Maybe it wasn't that long. Maybe no, it's not been that long. Seven, maybe eight?
I don't know if it would be seven or eight.
Yeah, you're right.
Do you think there was a research, do you think it showed, the importance of baseball in the Eau Claire culture when that happened? Because, I mean, I was there on opening night when Carson Park was just absolutely packed.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's really, that was a mirror of how important baseball was in Eau Claire, you know, back in the 50s and then again?
Yeah.
When the Cavaliers showed up and so on?
Yeah, definitely. I really do. I mean, I had always hoped, and when I was, you know, I was a sports writer in the 80s at the Leader, and I always kept hoping that there'd be these proposals that would come up or for a minor league team to come to Eau Claire, and they always fell through for one of two reasons. The minor league team, the major league team wanted all this money poured into Carson Park for their minor league team, and the city would always say, we can't spend $1 million on that park, and we don't have the money. You know, they weren't going to do that. Or I think the Cavaliers maybe tried to steer the minor league team away because it was their town and their local team, and I don't know that they were real crazy about having another team come in. And I don't know that for sure. That's probably anecdotal. But So I would always hope for a minor league team to come in to Eau Claire, and I was always excited, and I thought people would be excited about that. I sort of felt that from people that I had talked to and who just would always talk about the great days of the 50s and the 40s and the minor league teams. So I think there always was a yearning to have that level of baseball back here. You know, the Cavs have always been good, but you know, they just have never drawn a lot of people. And I think part of it is they're not connected to any sort of system where the Express, you know, are. I mean, they're connected to major colleges. They're connected to this big league. There's a pennant raised each year. There's some meaning to the games they play. They're very competitive. They're close games. The talent's good. So, yeah, I think, to me, when the Express came and there was that level of excitement for the Express, and there still is, I mean, there's still, what, the second or third best attended Northern League team? I think number three in attendance, I think.
I haven't heard numbers on that.
I know Madison and La Crosse are ahead of them, and then Express are right up there, maybe three or four. So, I mean, I think that says quite a bit for the fact that, you know, people still love baseball here, and part of it is the history. I mean, there's a lot of people in this. Art Roach is one. I always think of him. He's there every night, you know, and there's a lot of people, and I know other guys who watched the games in the 50s and grew up watching them, and they're there every night because they remember that great time in Eau Claire's history. And to them, that's almost as exciting now to see that kind of that whole atmosphere return. It has the feel of that kind of air of excitement about it. You've got, you know, a good crowd, I think, which is a big part of it. And I don't know if the good crowd begets the good crowd or what. I don't know how it all works, but people are just excited to be at the ballpark, you know. And there's that feeling that yeah, these guys are pretty good, and maybe they're going to go on to the major leagues. So it's a little bit like the 40s and 30s, 40s, 50s again. It's sort of that sense that these are top quality baseball players, and you're seeing, you know, seeing really good baseball. I think that all the time when I go there now. I think it's sort of the return of what we saw, you know, what people saw in the 40s, 50s in Eau Claire, and well into the early 60s. And it's very, very similar. You know, the crowds are a little bit bigger now, but Eau Claire is almost twice the size. So I think the average crowd at Carson Park now for Express games like around 2,000. By the time the season ends, you know, some of that gets skewed because most nights, you know, there's probably 1,200, 1,500. You know, but then you get the nights where there's 3,000 or 2,500 or the 4th of July when there's 3,500 or whatever. But, you know, the crowds are a little bigger average than I think they used to be. But again, like I said, it was about a 35,000 people town back in the 40s and 50s, and now you've got 65. So, I think there's, you know, the enthusiasm is, it's really cool to see it, that there's, it's always there. It's been there. You know, I think it was there, it was kind of latent, and it was just there all those years, and it just never could be exposed because there wasn't a team that got them excited or a league that the team could be in that got them excited like it does again now.
Guys, have anything there? I'm gonna save the Carson Park.
I guess I have a question.
Okay.
I met earlier today with Doug Smith, and he played first base in the 50s.
Right.
And he was talking about how when Hank Aaron came in the 52s, and when he was playing late in the 57s, 58s.
Yeah.
How much the how much the idea had changed about having African-American players in Eau Claire. He said there's still this curiosity about them, but he thought that how they were treated was much different in the late 50s than to the early 50s. And he went on to mention, you know, they stayed at the YMCA, they weren't allowed to stay in with other people. But I know you just said in the 50, the first guy that came, he stayed with the family.
Yeah.
So I was wondering what you thought about that. You know, I'm going through these oral history interviews, I'm talking to people and seeing what they think. You went through the same process interviewing people. They probably had a wide range of opinions.
Yeah, I would say there's probably a little. I mean, it's only 6 years. We're talking about 6 years. But, I mean, that's quite a bit of time when you think of the very first players coming first black players coming to Eau Claire, and now, you know, they've been there for 6-7 years, and you're some, I don't know how many they had per team in the late 50s. There might have been 3, 4, 5, maybe more. I'd have to look at some of the team photos. Probably not a lot more, but in the early 50s, you had 1 or 2. You know, that was it. I mean, Aaron's season, well, they had 3 in Aaron's season. The year before, they had, I think, just 1. It was a Horace Garner. Might have been another one.
Okay.
And in 51, there were 2. It was Bruton and this, I think it was Roy White, who was a pitcher, but I don't think he lasted the season. I believe he was gone. So I think it was just Bruton by the end of that season. So yeah, there's fewer players and fewer players on other teams, and now 6-7 years later, I think they're much more common. And yeah, as far as how they were treated, I suppose there was a little more of a sense of curiosity, and people were a little, maybe a little more afraid at first, although I got the sense that Bruton, you know, the very first one, I think part of it was his personality, but I understand he was just a really great guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he was just really friendly and had a great personality, and people, and he just connected well with people. Where Hank Aaron was not that sort of person. Wes Covington kind of was on that same team. Aaron wasn't. He was just a little more of a private person, and he can still sort of sense that the day he was here in 94. He's just a really nice guy, but he's just not the kind of person that you feel like going up to hug. He just has a little bit of a guard up with him, I think, at times, and that's just kind of the way he always has been, I think. He's just a little quieter person. So, I mean, how they were treated, I think, sometimes is a little bit of what type of person they are, too. You know, I think Covington, I read the one story where Covington went to the hospital, and there was the nurse who would come around and, like, fill his water pitcher without even ever going to his room because she was afraid of him. You know?
Right.
I think there was a little of that, but by the late 50s, some of that had disappeared a little bit. I think people had just gotten a little more used to having black players around town. But I don't remember any really anecdotally any stories much about whether they were treated differently socially, whether they could go places in 52 or 58 that they couldn't have gone in 52. I don't know that changed a whole lot, but Doug Smith maybe has a little better perspective because he was there. I mean,
right?
Yeah, but I get sense that it probably changed some. I mean, just because the community was a little more comfortable, maybe. But I always got the sense that the people in Eau Claire were fair to the black players. You know, I mean, there's probably a little bit. I mean, like Aaron said, he felt uncomfortable because people would stare at him. And he'd probably, you know, but you got to remember, every place he had been in his life, he was with other black people.
Right.
I mean, virtually. I mean, he grew up in the black South. He's on a black team playing in the black Negro leagues. And now he comes to Eau Claire, and like all of a sudden he's like in a fishbowl. And that would have been hard for him. I could see that. Yeah. But it was more just, again, a curiosity than anything else, I think, for people in Eau Claire. So that would have been a little hard, I think, for black players to come into this totally, almost totally white environment and feel comfortable. I don't think I would have felt comfortable.
Right.
I mean, just like if somebody dropped me in the middle of Harlem right now, you know, or in the 1950s, if somebody dropped me in the middle of Harlem, I'd probably think, you know, I'd probably look around and be a little scared. People would be looking at me, like, what are you doing here? I mean, it's just kind of the culture at the time. Yeah.
One of the things I was thinking of was, we have some groups talking about youth in baseball too, and working for the paper, I'm assuming you had to cover, you know, high school baseball and probably even some little league stuff.
Yeah.
What was that like? Was there a lot of that in Eau Claire, or did you guys do quite a bit of coverage of youth?
Not really. I mean, not really high school, but not really any youth baseball, like little league. I mean, the newspaper, I mean, I think we stopped our coverage at pretty much varsity baseball. Right. We didn't even do any JV.
Yeah.
You know, there might have been the occasional little league event that might have gotten a picture or something like that, but I never was. And I never even really covered a lot of baseball myself, some games here and there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Ron Buckley, who was the guy who's been at the paper forever, and he's still there, works, you know, part-time, but he's retired. He would tend to be the guy who would probably cover a little more baseball, but the sports season would be so long from football through baseball season, and by the time you get to the spring season, you didn't probably go out quite as much and cover events as maybe you did basketball. And spring sports were just not, didn't have quite the general interest that the winter sports did in terms of just newspaper. We put a lot in about it, but we didn't really probably go out and cover as many games physically. Some, but not a ton of it. Summertime, then you'd be covering more Cavs and, you know, some of that. But But yeah, I mean, Eau Claire's always been a great baseball town because it's just always been, I mean, there's been Legion, there's been Little League, there's been Cavaliers, there's, you know, the town teams around here, you got the, you know, the minor league teams. There's just always, a, I mean, it's baseball from every level, and it's been here that way for, I mean, you go back to the, like, in the 1860s, it's always been baseball teams here. It's kind of cool. And then you're talking about how it mirrors society. I mean, it's just, you know, and there's been baseball as part of America since that time, and it's just been kind of embedded in Eau Claire, that entire, virtually the entire history of the city has been baseball here. So I don't know that there's any other sports you could say that outside of maybe horseshoes. It's got the big horseshoe pitching thing.
International champions.
Yeah, that's right. So that might predate baseball a little bit, but that's about the only one I could think of. So I said, answer your question. I don't know, say too much about that. I don't know a lot about the other.
Yeah, I think my thinking was that you probably, you know, if a little league team went on to win the state tournament or something like that, obviously they'd get covered. But but it's hard. I mean, there's a lot of kids to cover.
Yeah, yeah,
a just, pretty big area. Too,
yeah, so. I just never really did a lot with youth sports because it was sort of the feeling that, you know, they'll get their chance when they get a little bigger in the paper. Let's see.
I guess I'm approaching probably the end here. Couple quick questions. So the immediate accommodations at Carson Park. How is that?
Did you say media or the?
The media accommodations at Carson Park. Just out of sheer curiosity.
You know, I never really covered games there in the 80s, other than if I did, there was baseball, maybe a high school game, and I would probably just sit in the stands. Now I've been up on top a couple of times, but not as an official member of the media, so I couldn't really give you much of a take on that. They look like they're not bad. I mean, they're better than they were from the stories I heard about people in the 40s and 50s. It was, you know, pretty Spartan up there. You had a little crow's nest, and you opened put the little wood thing down, and you looked down, and that was, you know, you had maybe a radio guy up there, and that was about it. But now I think they've actually got, don't they have like a camera for streaming video for the Express games up there? I think, you know, the TV stations have a pretty good spot to set up a camera up there. I think the news guys have, I think it's decent. You know, certainly nothing like going to Miller Park, but I think it's, you know, at least reasonable. Yeah, but it was never built. You know, you look at that kind of crow's nest up there, and it was never really built with the media in mind. I mean, there's no real press box or anything. I guess it kind of is now, but. Yeah, but it's not really not really that media friendly overall, I would say.
All right, I guess we're gonna close the interview with.
I have another question out of curiosity.
Okay.
What's like the most memorable baseball game you've been to?
Oh.
Have you been to a perfect game or a big playoff game or anything?
You know, I went to the World Series in '82. It seems to me, you know. There were a couple games there. I mean, I remember, I think the one that kind of stands out with me, though, I'm pretty sure it was the game the Brewers won to get to the World Series. I think they were down in that American League Championship game to California. Was it 3-1 in the series? And they came back to win it. Didn't they clinch at that County Stadium?
I think so.
I'm pretty sure that's the game I was at.
Yeah.
If I can remember correctly. It was either that or the game before. So, I mean, there were a couple. It's terrible not to remember if it was the 6th or 7th. It was one of the last two games that they won to either get to the 7th game or win the 7th game to get to the World Series. I mean, that really stands out in my mind. I remember just the excitement of being in County Stadium. I got to go as media too, which was cool.
Oh, yeah. So you got good seats.
Oh yeah, there. Yeah. It was.
Oh man.
So I mean, that was pretty exciting. I still got programs and like the media credential from being to a World Series. So that was pretty neat.
So yeah. I was gonna ask. So you went to the World Series too? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Did you have to get a ticket, or was that some media?
I got a media pass to one of those too. Yeah, yeah. It was
pretty
lucky. Yeah,
that's pretty cool. Because when the Brewers were in the playoffs this year, we were thinking about getting tickets for the second round or whatever, because we would be back home, and they're way too expensive for a college kid.
Yeah.
Even in the bleachers.
That's one thing with the media. I mean, you know, I can't say I've gotten rich being in the media over the years, but I've gotten to do some things that the average person hasn't been able to. Like I've been in the locker room at the U.S. Open. You know, I've been in the, I was in the Yankees locker room when I was writing this book.
Right, yeah.
I mean, that was like, okay, I'm walking in, and I just kind of pinching myself. Even though it was at the Metrodome, it wasn't the Yankee Stadium, but I was like pinching myself. Because they were right in the middle of like this 100-plus win season. They were like one of the great teams of all time. It's like, okay, I'm walking in the Yankees locker room. Like, okay, there's Paul O'Neill, there's Kirk Strawberry, there's Rivera. I was like, oh my gosh. I was, you know, it almost like it was kind of hyperventilated a little bit. You know, then I'm trying to find Joe Torre, and I walk in, and he's in this little cubicle getting dressed for the game. I was like, what am I doing in here? He's putting on his pants. It's like, oh man. To me, that's pretty cool to do some of that stuff, you know, and just to talk to some of the people. I mean, to interview, you know, Andy Pafko, and I think Burley Grimes was dead before I, you know, wrote this book, but I interviewed like the guy that was his best friend, you know, and hear some of the firsthand stories. Wes Westrom, you know, he's on the cover of the very first Sports Illustrated. You know, I mean, interview him up in his hometown in Clear Brook, Minnesota, and then he died a few years later. I mean, to have those opportunities is pretty cool. Yeah, there's probably other memorable games. You know, like the first baseball game I ever went to, I think I wrote about it, and there was the day Nixon resigned. You know, but I got to see Robin Yount play. He was a rookie that year. I mean, that was just, I still remember walking up the ramp in County Stadium because I'd never seen a major league ballpark. And we had a bunch of buddies that went down from, I lived in La Crosse and went down there to watch the game. And I still remember that thought of, for the very first time seeing a major league field. And, you know, it's just, it's like, wow, this is, here it is. I've been listening to the games on the radio for probably 4 or 5 years. You know, to finally see the stadium then was really something, I thought. Yeah. So, I mean, those things kind of stick with you over the years. But, yeah, it's a lot of different memories. I have to stop and think about some of them. But I've been a big golf fan over the years, too. So, I mean, I've had some really fun opportunities there to go play some media days and play some of the courses where they had the U.S. Open. Like I played Hazeltine and played Medina. You know, beyond these courses, you know, I mean, obviously there's no tournament going on, but still to say you, then when you go watch the Open, you say, I played that hole. It's pretty neat. It's a lot of fun.
I guess last question. How did the Brewers do this year without Fielder?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't know. You know, the pitching's back, which really, that's been notoriously the Brewers, you know, trouble spot for almost their entire history of the Brewers. They've had bad pitching for so many years, and this year it was so fun to see them actually be in so many games because their pitching was good. You know, and they had a lot of close games that they, you know, the bullpen comes in and it lights out. So I still think they do pretty well because of the pitching. If the pitching is as good as last year, you know, and they got Greinke for the whole season as opposed to, you know,
the last half of it.
Yeah, and they got the setup man, is it Rodriguez again? What's his name again?
Yeah.
K-Rod. Yeah, K-Rod got him back, and they got Axford back. So, I mean, like, if the pitching is as good as it is, I don't think they do a lot worse than last year because it seemed to me like they strengthened themselves a little bit in some other areas. You know, I mean, Ramirez, you know, could produce numbers if he has a good season, maybe just slightly below what Fielder does. Mm-hmm. Kind of hard to know, but that could hurt Braun a little bit, you know, not having Fielder right behind him. He's probably going to get fewer pitches to hit than he did. So, I don't know. It's pretty fun to watch. But you know, I mean, you always hope baseball is always kind of the hope springs eternal thing where you think, well, maybe Gamble will be this great young player, you know. And it looks like he's having a good spring so far. So you hope some rookie comes in and just, you know, kind of like St. Louis last year. I can't remember the guy's name, but I was mad at him. By the end of the World Series, you know, he had this incredible playoff. Yeah. So, yeah, I just hope they continue the way they've been going because it's sure been fun to see them be good for a change because there's too many lean years. I mean, I grew up watching them being really bad for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the whole 70s was just, late 70s, they started getting pretty good for a while. But I mean, from the time they arrived till about when Mahler and Yount arrived, late 70s, they were just really bad. Oh, man. Yeah, they just, you know, Euchre always made them sound exciting, but they weren't that good. Yeah, well, that's good.